This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big new team is jumping in on the economy, mid-stimulus, mid-TARP, most of all, mid-crisis. Obama's Economic Brain Trust has some big-name brains, but we are changing horses in one heck of a stream. Over $10 trillion in federal debt and Bush-era obligations, a first bailout fund already half spent, and plenty of criticism out there from lawmakers and the public. What's next? This hour, On Point, High Wire Act, the Bush to Obama economic handoff. You can join the conversation when all the money is out the door. Will this crisis be licked? And what are you expecting from Team Obama after 8 years of Team Bush? Joining me in the studio today is Linda Bilmes. She's a leading expert on budgeting and public finance, former Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Commerce Department, lectures on public finance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is co-author with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz of The $10 Trillion Hangover, Paying the Price for 8 Years of Bush, an article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Co-author also with Stiglitz of the book The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Linda Bilmes, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So here we are, right in the thick of it, in the swirl of it, the handover well and truly underway, the news that keeps coming out on the economy bad. Give us your snapshot just to begin, Linda. I mean, there's sort of a mid-range and huge range, but where are we in this crisis to resolution rumba that we got into in a fierce way in the last few months? Where does it stand today?
Well, where we are is that the economy is deteriorating very rapidly. Unemployment is growing. The TARP has not worked, and people are scared. I think the world, however, is holding its breath and waiting to see how quickly Obama and the new economic team can stem the decline. And the next 6 weeks are critical because in the next 6 weeks, the team and the Congress will be considering the renewal of TARP, the economic stimulus package, and the rest of the budget for this year. So really the decisions that are made in the next 4 to 6 weeks will determine the outcome of the next 2 years.
The Senate taking up TARP, that's the money that has gone to banks so far. Today, as we speak, not a vote on that yet. Could be today, maybe tomorrow. But that's a big deal. And then comes the whole stimulus package. Barack Obama talking about $775 billion, people now saying $850 billion. Where do you stand on the too big or too small debate, Linda? We hear and read both lines of thinking.
Well, in terms of the stimulus, I think that, as Larry Summers has put it, it is much more likely that we would err on the side of being too small than being too big.
In other words, in a crisis like this, the danger of doing too little greater than the danger of doing too much, in spite of the debt that comes with the stimulus?
Well, that's right, because what you basically have is a situation where if you were an individual who had a lot of credit card debt and other debt, and you suddenly realized that you had cancer and needed very expensive treatment, it's a question of survival. I mean, if you have to borrow more money in order to have the medicine to survive— You have to do it. You have no choice. And the challenge right now for the economy, which is in that situation, is essentially to survive and to prosper. And then, unfortunately, it will have to pay back not only what we borrow now, but the albatross of the debt that we've taken on during the Bush administration.
What are we trying to avoid here? What are the stakes? Are we indeed? Do you think you say people are scared? Public at large, clearly. I mean, who wouldn't be? With we see what's happening with unemployment, the markets, savings, retirement, and everything else. But what's the rim that we're on here? Is a depression still imminently the danger in front of us?
Well, I think that the stakes were outlined very clearly in a paper that came out last week by Christina Romer, who is the president's economic advisor, and Jared Bernstein, who is the vice president's economic advisor. And what they outlined was that without a stimulus package, the unemployment rate was likely to hit 8.8%. And they also outlined a number of parameters around the economy that they kind of played out what it would look like without a stimulus, and it was not pretty. Now, the purpose of the stimulus is to try to mitigate against some of those dangers with the stimulus package, and they had envisaged a slightly smaller one than the one that Congress is looking at now. Unemployment would be reduced to about 7%.
So still not great at all.
Still not great at all. But there's still a big difference in the economy between 7% and 8.8 or 9%.
I want to understand where we're coming from here in this handoff from Bush to Obama, what the Obama team is going to be dealing with. Here's President Bush in his final press conference on Monday defending his record on the economy.
Look, I inherited a recession. I'm ending on a recession. In the meantime, there were 52 months of uninterrupted job growth. And I defended tax cuts when I campaigned. I helped implement tax cuts when I was president. And I will defend them after my presidency as the right course of action.
President Bush standing up for his 52 months of uninterrupted job growth, as he puts it there. Of course, that's different from the net and his tax cuts. Linda, how would you describe what's being handed to the Obama team by the Bush team when it comes to the economy?
Well, I think that the purpose of having a good period of time and job growth and economic growth is that those are the times when you should be saving. And if you look back at what happened during the Clinton administration, when we were doing well, economically speaking, he balanced the budget and he started paying down the federal debt. That's what we should have been doing during the Bush years. Instead, during those good times, what did we do? We actually doubled our federal debt from $5.7 trillion to $11 trillion. We doubled it. So we amassed more debt under President Bush's administration than we had in all 42 previous presidents combined. And this is a result of the combination of tax cuts and a huge increase in spending, both for the Iraq war, for the defense buildup, unrelated to the war, and for things like the poorly constructed Medicare Part D prescription plan. So it was extremely poor economic decisions. But in addition, if you actually look at where the growth came from, what we now see is that a lot of the growth during the Bush years was fueled by mortgage equity withdrawals. If you actually took out...
That is home loans. People took against the
right.
market value at that time of their homes, which was up and up.
Right. But they were not even based on people's ability to repay those loans. They were based on the speculative hopes of what those homes would be worth in the future. And because of the fact that the regulation environment was so lax, and in fact the Bush administration tried very hard to stymie many regulatory efforts in the states and municipalities, because of that, much of this growth was growth that actually just came out of home equity withdrawals. And if you look at where the growth went and where the tax cuts went, most of that went to the top 1% of the population. So it really was a very, very skewed and inequitable kind of a growth. And it was not salted away for bad times.
So you write with Joseph Stiglitz about the $10 trillion hangover. Is that the same $10 trillion or $11 trillion that you're describing here?
Well, no, not exactly. It's coincidentally the same number. The $10 trillion hangover that we describe is the amount of sort of economic worsening in the economy that is directly attributable to decisions made by the Bush administration. And that is a combination of the additional debt that was taken on, the tax cuts that were siphoned out of the economy, the Medicare Part D prescription plan, which was
helping seniors buy drugs.
It was, which is a good idea, but because under the terms of the law, the government is not allowed to negotiate with drug companies, unlike, for example, the veterans' hospitals, it is much more expensive than it needs to be, as well as other long-term requirements and commitments made during the Bush administration.
You're throwing in there, for example, the cost of rebuilding the U.S. military after its kind of erosion under the weight of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right. I mean, the cost of providing benefits to our veterans and the cost over the next 10 years and the cost of replenishing the military hardware that's being used up at a very, very rapid rate. But in addition, I mean, there's been an enormous sort of human cost. I mean, the article talks about both the economic cost and the human cost, and the human cost in terms of the rising inequity in society, the rising number of people without health insurance, the loss of manufacturing jobs, the high unemployment rates. Everything that could possibly be tracked by economists has gotten worse over the past 8 years, and I think that people realize this. People know it.
With all that, are Obama's hands tied, or is the United States, because it can print money, still free to do whatever is required with your $10 trillion hangover and your $11 trillion in federal debt doubled in the last 8 years, you say? Does it restrict Obama's options or not, starting next Tuesday, starting now, really?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, I think that he is starting with a clean slate, with a enormous reservoir of goodwill from the population, with a strong Democratic majority in the House. And so, you know, he has a kind of a mandate from people and a goodwill to try and move boldly in new directions. On the other hand, it is much, much easier to do this if you are not saddled with what is now close to $15 trillion in debt once you include the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac takeovers and so forth. It is clearly better to do that. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, we have to repay debt with interest, and the interest comes off the operating budget that we spend every year. So every year, the fourth largest item that we spend in our budget is actually interest payments. Now, he has less room for maneuver in the annual operating budget to spend money because of the fact that we have racked up all of this debt and we have to pay interest on it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the high wire economic handoff, Bush to Obama, and rescuing the bailout. Linda Bilmes is with us, former Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer in the U.S. Commerce Department, now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author with the Nobel Prize-winning economist, co-author with Joe Stiglitz of the $10 trillion hangover, paying the price for 8 years of Bush in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. On Monday, President-elect Obama promised a change in how bailout funds have been allocated, pledging a renewed focus on housing and small business. He also said he was unhappy with how money had been used so far.
When this initial vote was approved by Congress, I think there were expectations of clarity and transparency and openness in how the program would be managed. There were expectations that we would deal directly with housing and the foreclosure crisis that exists in this country. I think many of us have been disappointed with the absence of clarity, the lack of transparency, the failure to track how the money's been spent.
Barack Obama on Monday. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi told ABC's Good Morning America yesterday that she, Congress, was furious over how TARP had been managed so far and said she was sure that things would change if there's more sign-off on TARP under the new administration.
Things will be different because we will have a president who will enforce the law. And again, with the light of transparency on it, that will be built into any new, if there is to be any more TARP funding.
Right. We shall see. Let's begin to hear from our listeners. Chuck in Ashland, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a remodeling contractor in my 25th year running the business, and while I can't quite speak to the big picture, I think that this change of administration will be affecting my industry quickly and for the better.
How, Chuck?
My simple take on the economy is that this, at least my area, the American economy runs on faith and hope, which has really been crushed, and that's one of the biggest things Obama's bringing into this new office. The sense of hope.
And is it because he's promising to unleash that, whatever it is, $800 billion in stimulus spending, or that something else, that plus?
I kind of take it as it's a general feeling that hasn't been here for a long time, that things may get better. When things, people believe there's a future, that there are things to invest in, at least in my industry, people start investing in their homes, and they've been putting that off for a long time, and this is the worst recession I've seen in 25 years.
There's hope from a remodeler. And Chuck, thanks for your call. Chuck, let's go to Stan, Lexington, Massachusetts. Stan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was calling because I'm concerned about TARP, and it's based on a flawed notion that banks actually lend money. The last 40 years, they've moved to fee-based businesses. That's the business model. And what they do is they originate and they service, and then they sell loans off into a securitization market.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you fix that marketplace, you're going to never really get to the bottom of the problem. The banks don't own the mortgages. We're asking for relief here. They're actually owned by pools that are not subject to any kind of regulation. And you need to fix the securitization market or nothing's going to ever get done.
Stan, let us pick it up. Linda Bellman's big picture here. On the one hand, some confidence there from a remodeler saying faith and hope matter. Obama may bring that. That would be great for his industry and no doubt others. On the other hand, Stan says, let's look at what happened with TARP already. Billions and billions just kind of gone poof into bank vaults or nobody exactly knows where. And in any case, he says, they don't lend. Do you expect something different? So what people have really seen so far is TARP front and center. And what's the evolution of this to be if we're going to be successful here?
Well, there's no question we've gotten a very raw deal on TARP, and it's a $350 billion raw deal.
That's just the first half.
Which is just the first half. On Friday, Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren, who chairs a bipartisan commission, issued a truly scathing report on the first half of TARP, which concluded that, first of all, we don't really understand where the money went because the transparency was so poor, and secondly, perhaps more importantly, that no TARP money so far has gone to help homeowners. So I think that the second half of TARP will be much, much more carefully restricted, and certainly Barney Frank wants to put a requirement that a significant portion of it is actually used for home foreclosure relief. However, Barney Frank is talking about spending $50 billion or so on home foreclosure relief, and the question is—
This is the Democratic Massachusetts congressman right in the center of all this.
That's right. The question then is what happens to the other $300 billion, and $300 billion is a lot of money. So I think what we found in the first part of TARP is that the devil is really in the details in terms of the restrictions on TARP. And unless it is restricted and targeted and there is very, very careful oversight, the money stands a chance of, again, you know, not being very well spent. So I think both callers are right. I think there is a sense of a hope and optimism that Obama is bringing in, but I think there is a fairly short window in which we can get some of these things right. And one of the things that will sustain that hope is that people see that we are not going to give a free ride to the large banks with the second part of TARP.
Well, on the other hand, you've still got banks that look like they're almost in free fall, taking more and more billions out of the Fed window and TARP and all the rest, Citigroup. You know, chopping itself up into pieces to try and stay alive. And our caller Stan says the way our banking industry itself has evolved works against stability here because it's just chopped up, sold off, securitized. I mean, there's a linkage between regulation and recovery, perhaps?
Well, I think the problem is that what we're seeing with the TARP is that the trickle-down idea, which hasn't worked in the economy, also doesn't work with the banks. So if we really want to inject liquidity into the economy, we need to be supporting the local and regional banks, not just the giant banks. And secondly, we haven't gotten much for our money. If you look at the amount of money that we put into Citibank, for example, it is far more than the sort of 7% that we now own. So we've essentially just transferred U.S. taxpayer dollars as a sort of gift to the Saudis, who are the largest shareholders in Citibank. I mean, the caller is correct that the way that this thing has been sort of thought through has not really considered the best way to inject liquidity into the communities. You know, personally, I'm in favor of much more money going to small local banks.
Linda, shift the frame forward then. A lot of talk about TARP this week. Whatever happens will happen with that. But then comes the big stimulus, $775 billion or $800 or $850 or a trillion, wherever it ends up. How is that likely to be structured as you watch it evolving in conversation between Obama, Congress, and the rest? And can Americans expect more transparency, more effectiveness in that huge stimulus?
Well, the stimulus package, which is going to be taken up by the Senate, but the House Ways and Means Committee in a couple of weeks, basically has three parts. The first part are tax cuts. The second are sort of infrastructure investments. And the third is direct aid to states. So if I can take them in kind of mm-hmm. reverse order,
yep.
I think that the direct aid to states, and this is essentially to help states and municipalities pay for Medicaid, pay to not lay off workers and teachers and social workers and so forth, that part of it is absolutely critical. And that part probably will work pretty well.
Because their revenues are plummeting. If they don't have some kind of life raft, they're going to start laying off people. Is the central importance there, what, the services, the jobs, the how do you describe it?
Well, I think it's both. You know, states, unlike the federal government, are not allowed to go into deficit. And so if they are very heavily dependent on sales tax revenue and income tax, state income tax. So they are already feeling an enormous pinch. And they provide, of course, many, many key services, including Medicaid. Now, the cities are even worse hit because they are essentially dependent on property taxes. And property taxes, they haven't even really felt the pain yet because property taxes get reevaluated annually.
Annually? So that's all going to chunk down as the new lower values come into effect?
That's right. And we heard here in Boston Tom Menino talking about the $140 million shortfall in Boston.
And that's just one big American city. We've got listeners all over thinking about their own cities.
All over the country, the cuts to cities directly affect teachers, they affect firefighters, they affect policemen, they affect all kinds of city workers, and those are direct services. They affect the bus routes into cities. So
that'll be one big piece of the stimulus pie then, just keeping that afloat. Take us on down that list.
Right. I mean, the second part is these tax cuts, and what they are talking about now is having both a sort of $500 per person individual tax cut, and then there are a number of kind of controversial tax initiatives which have been proposed. One is a business tax cut to allow companies to apply their net operating losses going back 5 years instead of two, which would basically generate instant refunds to a lot of businesses. And there's a lot of talk about reforming the alt-min tax, the child tax credit, college tuition tax
credits. But there's $150 billion or so in business tax cuts in here. Do you see those as necessary to have the thing go through Congress with the kind of support Obama wants?
Well, I mean, I think that it's very clear that the tax cuts are not nearly as stimulative as spending, you know, spending in the states and infrastructure spending. And the report issued—
Why not? It's money in people's pockets. It's money in the business kitty.
Well, it has a lower economic multiplier. So money that's spent on a bridge or a road or given to the states actually goes through the economy more.
Mm-hmm.
And the report that came out by Christina Romer last week mm-hmm. Actually went through and concluded pretty strongly, I mean, which is pretty accepted among economists, that the tax cuts would not have as much of a stimulative effect as the other parts of the stimulus package. I think that the purpose of the tax cuts is, first of all, the president-elect is delivering on a campaign promise. And secondly, politically
speaking, individual families.
To individual families mm-hmm. to make this middle-class tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, politically speaking, to get bipartisan support in Congress for it, I mean, he needs to include tax cuts. The danger with the tax cuts is that there are so many special interests in Congress that have their own particular opinions on different types of tax cuts that the whole thing kind of bogs down around the tax cuts. And they have to make sure that they essentially deliver the tax cuts and don't get bogged down in 20 different ways to cut taxes.
So there's the handoff piece. They're handing off the sort of tax-cutting dynamic of the Bush years, some big supporters and some opponents of that. Then you come to the huge element of infrastructure itself. What kind, how fast, and is it really effective for the crisis we're in right now?
Well, you know, and this is a very, very important point. I mean, the infrastructure part of this is really the part that actually creates new jobs. There are projects which which cities have – there are 15,000 projects around the country that the National Conference of Mayors have proposed. Those projects are very, very wide-ranging, ranging from sort of sewage treatment plants to putting fences around dog parks. You know, some of them are great projects and some of them are not. The question is, you know, how are we going to set up criteria for sort of making sure that we have good, stimulative – shovel-ready projects that don't require a lot of decision-making, a lot of environmental impact statements, a lot of approvals, which basically lead to delay. And
on the other hand, people expect to hope for a lot out of this in terms of laying down infrastructure for a new century, not just new dog pens. Let's take a call here from Angelo in Hamden, Connecticut. Angelo, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have a suggestion. Why not a federal jobs program? 4 million jobs, $80,000 per job, including benefits, would come out to $320 billion.
You'd have people lining up around the block for that, Angelo.
Well, it would have a significant multiplier effect. And you could provide money to state and local governments and private enterprise to subsidize the hiring of additional employees.
What do you want them to do? Is this like the old WPA? You want them to make new trails in the national parks, paint murals in your town hall?
Well, there are significant demands out in state and local governments. We need social workers. We need teachers. We need police officers, firefighters. You could hire people to build roads, to repair roads and bridges and so forth. There, the infrastructure needs significant investment.
Angelo, hang on. I want Linda to engage with you directly here. Is that sort of what we are talking about in the infrastructure program or different, Linda?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. What we're talking about is we're basically talking about hiring people to build new trails, to repair veterans' hospitals, to rebuild schools, to try and create a variety of environmentally improving projects along the way, for example, to replace windows and to retrofit buildings to become more energy efficient. We are talking about job creation. I think that the issue is simply that to do this, to create jobs in terms of building things, takes some time. It's not going to happen tomorrow. And so really we're looking at a sort of at least a year time frame before you actually get the projects going.
We'll talk about the time frame, but Angelo, is that more or less what you're describing?
That's what I'm describing. I mean, that's what's necessary because people are losing jobs and that's what's causing the contraction in the economy. These people don't have money to spend.
But we have to do, Angelo, you know, two things. I mean, first of all, we have to protect the jobs that we have. And so many of jobs in state and local government are at risk right now that we want to spend some money on making sure that we don't lose more jobs to try and stem the flow. And then there's creating new jobs.
And if it's going to take a year, what about the timing? I mean, do we really have a year? The crisis bells seem to be clanging all over the place.
Well, that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges of this. This is part of the reason for creating the tax cut and for providing direct aid to states to try and stop the loss in terms of jobs. But we really need to figure out a way to fund the things like recurring maintenance projects and things that really, truly are shovel-ready and necessary and beneficial very, very quickly. And this in every other infrastructure project the government has been involved in, whether it's the Big Dig or the post-Katrina reconstruction or certainly the reconstruction efforts in Iraq, the ability for a large government bureaucracy to move quickly on these infrastructure projects has continued to be a problem.
Let me get one more call before the break. Angelo, thanks for yours. Paul in Beaufort, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. Two points, I think. Number one, I've never seen very many government programs where public money is used, especially when there's a lot of zeros after the number. They've been well run. We usually read about it years later where there's a lot of corruption and the money actually didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, always a problem.
Article. There was a great article in the newspaper today, the New York Times article. I don't recall who wrote it. A great solution proposed. Why not put a very, very small transaction fee on stock exchanges, like a quarter of a percent? And it had the article talked about the potential to raise $100 billion a year doing this. That's the first benefit. And the second benefit is that it would also dissuade these speculators who, of course, work on very, very small margins, like 1%. And if they were faced with a quarter percent transaction fee on every one of these thousands and thousands of transactions that they do value, by the way, we might get a twofold benefit from that.
Paul, we see you're all over it. Everybody's thinking hard about this. Maybe that's a way. We'll come back and look at both of those observations and much more. We're looking at the high wire economic handoff, Bush to Obama, underway. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the high wire economic handoff, Bush to Obama, underway right now, and rescuing the bailout itself. Linda Bilmes is with us. She lectures on budgeting and public finance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of the $10 trillion hangover in this month's issue of Harper's with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, and of the $3 trillion war, the cost of the Iraq conflict. Barack Obama complaining loud and long last week about the kind of ethic and approach that has brought us to this spot. Let's listen back to his diagnosis here at George Mason University last Thursday. Let's listen.
We arrived at this point due to an era of profound irresponsibility that stretched from corporate boardrooms to the halls of power in Washington, D.C. For years, too many Wall Street executives made imprudent and dangerous decisions, seeking profits with too little regard for risk, too little regulatory scrutiny, and too little accountability. Banks made loans without concern for whether borrowers could repay them, and some borrowers took advantage of cheap credit to take on debt they couldn't afford. Politicians spent taxpayer money without wisdom or discipline, and too often focused on scoring political points instead of problems they were sent here to solve.
Barack Obama with his litany of complaints right there. Linda Bilmes, just before the break, Paul in South Carolina saying, A, he's never seen that much money spent really well by a government. There's always waste and inefficiency involved. And B, he's looking for new sources of revenue here, maybe even a little tax on stock trades, 0.25% or so that might tamp down speculation, bring in another $100 billion or so a year. He says, what about how it's spent and new revenue streams?
Well, I think that, first of all, the president-elect said it very well, you know, that there is a lot of blame to go around, and we've been through an era in the last decade of enormous personal consumption, which has fueled the global economy. And much of that consumption essentially sort of built on unsound premises. So we now have so much debt in the economy that the question is how to deleverage the economy. And I think that in terms of the caller's suggestion, this is the kind of thing, you know, having additional sources of revenue that we should have been doing when the economy was doing well. Instead of borrowing all of the money to pay for the Iraq war, for example, we should have had other sources of revenue to help pay for that war, as we did, for example, during World War II. But now we're at the point where people are hurting, and the question is how to stimulate the economy and how to deleverage this huge amount of household debt, as well as how to stimulate the economy, which has already got so much debt.
But
so we're kind of at a different – we're at a different point now in terms of what we need to do.
So maybe people will buy in that there's a crisis, we've got to do what we've got to do, but how much swing is there? You're a budgeting and public finance person. Between spending this well and spending it poorly? I mean, is there a kind of a mean that government spending tends to go to no matter what in terms of effectiveness? How much does it matter? You know, how deeply on guard should American citizens be about exactly how this money gets spent?
Well, I think that the area of biggest risk is the infrastructure spending. And certainly if you look back at the Iraq reconstruction effort, the Hurricane Katrina reconstruction effort, and the Big Dig. What you see
is the big project in through the middle of Boston, putting a highway underground.
Right, which is the nation's
trillions.
Largest
mm-hmm.
infrastructure project. What the lessons of those three projects is that there was a very high amount of fraud and waste and inefficiency in those large-scale projects, as well as the fact that certainly in the case of the Boston redig and in Iraq, the money was spent very, very slowly.
So why will this be different?
What we are trying to do is spend something efficiently and quickly. Well, I mean, I think one is hoping that we can look at some of the lessons of these previous efforts and try to mitigate against the risk. Whenever you have a large government bureaucracy or a large bureaucracy of any kind that is ramping up spending very, very quickly, there is always the risk of waste and fraud and inefficiency. So we have to do it with our eyes open.
Is that risk particularly high because it's coming in with a major handover of administrations at the same time?
I actually think that the risk is less because it's coming with a handover administration.
Fresh eyes coming in.
I think fresh eyes coming in, and I think that we have had such a very, very poor administration of the TARP that there is a lot of recognition right now that we have to do a better job in terms of oversight. But there's no question that when you are handing out hundreds of billions of dollars to municipalities for projects where they have to figure out how to get the money out the door, how to get the projects done, how to award contracts, how to award the bids, how to run the contracts, manage them, and so forth, that there are some risks. And I think that this leads to a very important point, which is that there has been a lot of focus about the people at the very top of the economic team. But the implementation of the economic stimulus package and the implementation of the TARP and everything else we do is in the hands of the hundreds of thousands of people who work at the Treasury and at the FDIC and at the Federal Reserve and at Fannie Mae and so forth.
Hundreds of thousands of people?
There are hundreds of thousands. There are 100,000 employees at the Treasury. There are 10,000 at Fannie and Freddie. Mm-hmm. There are 18,000 at the Fed.
Will those change or will it be the same crew?
This is the same group of people. These are the career people. And this is where we have an enormous challenge because we have underinvested, really seriously underinvested in these hundreds of thousands of implementers in the government who are in charge of making sure.
Underinvested meaning what?
Meaning that these, we have not.
They don't have the chops to do it?
Meaning that we have not invested in training our career public servants. We have not invested in hiring the best and the brightest coming out of colleges, meaning that we have not invested in retaining the best and the brightest. So we now have a situation where 90% of the senior administrators in government are eligible to retire, and we have a lot of difficulty in hiring new people. You know, for example, at the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that one of the callers was mentioning, mm-hmm. they have lost 2,000 people over the last 8 years. So they've gone from 6,000 to 4,000 people, and they haven't been able to hire the kind of people who they want to, who need to understand and regulate all of these complicated financial instruments.
Well, one would guess that there'll be a lot more bright young kids at the door of the SEC for jobs at the end of this school year than there have been in recent years when they all went straight off to Goldman Sachs. Let's go to Eric in Southbridge, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hey, I love your show. I wanted to mention something that is, I think, very important to this conversation. That is the opportunity cost. That is, what does $700 billion mean? And I would wager that not one person in 1,000 has even the vaguest understanding. Here's what $700 billion would buy.
Okay.
It would buy a two-track, 200-mile-an-hour maglev train connecting every city in the United States and all the stations and all the power stations and 1,200 maglev cars.
For sure? Really? Over the Rockies and all the rest?
All of it. And my point is that $700 billion is an insane amount of money. It would, for example, pave a highway 4 miles wide, 12 inches deep in concrete and rebar from coast to coast.
I don't want a 4-mile-wide highway, but maglev everywhere sounds kind of attractive. What's your bottom line there, though, Eric, that you'd rather spend it on maglev or that it's just too insanely large for us to take on board?
Oh, I'd spend it on the maglev in a heartbeat. However, my point is that, people have this cognitive consonance with millions, billions, and trillions where they just don't understand the magnitude of what a particular amount of money means. It's astonishing.
Eric, you put it well. Let me hold that thought and get another here from Robin in Winchester, Massachusetts. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just calling to make the point that I have been hearing for weeks about shovel-ready projects, and there are many good projects that need to be designed and go through environmental permitting, and many environmental managers such as myself and architects who would benefit by the jobs to do that work that runs up to construction. So there seems to be a blind spot about employing just construction workers when there are many other professionals who need jobs as well.
Robin, thanks very much for that. Linda Bilmes, these two kind of go together. You know, first, Eric says, hey, maglev connecting every city, two tracks, 200 miles per hour, whole new day in American transportation. For $700 billion, you could do it. But Robin says, we don't have that kind of time horizon here. We're talking shovel ready. It sounds like just throw up whatever you can do tomorrow. What about all the brain power and time that would go into bigger, deeper, maybe more important infrastructure?
Well, I think there are two kinds of projects. You know, one are the immediate recurring maintenance type of projects like painting schools, which need to be done anyway. And these things are things that can be done relatively quickly. I mean, and the second are the, you know, fairly long-term infrastructure projects, you know, like computerizing the medical records and improving access to broadband and rebuilding the electricity grid and improving and increasing investments in R&D across the board and making a real concerted effort to change the way our buildings and transportation is run so that it's more environmentally efficient. Both of these, I think, are extremely valuable. And the challenge is just to figure out a way to run these projects so that we get enough stimulus into the economy quickly through the recurring maintenance type of projects and at the same time begin these projects that will benefit the economy over the long term.
But if this is our one big shot because the debt is mounting, the payments on that are mounting, we're not going to have $1 trillion to throw around this way and that, you know, every other month for the rest of even Obama's time, right. I assume. Do you feel confident that we're lining up in this handoff to spend that trillion in the optimal fashion, or are we already making political compromises that are going to leave us with a bunch of money spent, but not necessarily the new footing we need to push into a whole new era?
You know, I'm not in Washington managing the politics, but if I were designing the stimulus, I would put a lot more – I would, first of all, expand the time frame. So we're looking not just at a 2-year time frame, but really looking at a 5-year time frame. And I would put more money into those things that will be creating good jobs and energy independence and environmental efficiency over the time frame of 2, 3, 4 years, and less money up front into tax cuts, which we know don't stimulate the economy as much.
Could we do that, or do we need the spending right now to pull this thing out of the nosedive, as George Bush kind of said?
You know, I think you
this
have
– sucker could go down, I think the president's words were.
Right. I think that the – you know, you have some of the finest economic minds in the country who are really looking at this and trying to craft the stimulus. And I have every confidence that Larry Summers, who is you know, certainly the most brilliant economist of his generation
– former Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard, it turns out. Mm-hmm.
You know, as well as Christy Romer and Jeff Liebman and mm-hmm. Peter Orszag and the rest of the team there are looking very, very hard at these kind of issues. What I think is always difficult in Washington are the political compromises that have to be made. So the question, I guess, for the public is to what extent, in order to get a political compromise, is this stimulus package being put into things like tax cuts, which are less stimulative as opposed to the infrastructure projects, which will be more. However, we, as we've talked about, we need to get a balance between these short-term projects and the probably better for the economy, but projects that take a longer time to get off the ground.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Ernie. Ernie, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you. the way they want to spend the money is the way people think, and it's always wrong. It's incorrect. You want to spend all the money on roads and bridges, and automobiles is part of the problem in this country. As the gentleman said earlier, the maglev is perfect, but not only the maglev, but we need to rethink how everything is done. It's time for a completely new concept. We need solar plants in the Midwest. We need 1 million wind generators. We need to build pipelines to move water from flooded areas to areas that need water. We need completely new manufacturing facilities. We need engineering schools.
Ernie, I love the way you're thinking. Do you believe that that will or can be part of a stimulus package that's also needed to take to kick in right now, Ernie?
Absolutely. This is what we have to do. If we do this, we could shut coal plants down in 4 or 5 years. It's totally possible. It can be done. We can build plasma generating power plants inside a city and burn the garbage. We can recycle 95% of all aluminum plastic. People just do not understand what is possible if you use the engineering. And this country is completely in the wrong direction, and it has turned the other direction.
Ernie, I'd put you right in charge day one if I could, but where we're actually going, Linda, are we going to be able to have that kind of vision, that kind of push, that kind of ambition, or is Ernie ahead of the need right now?
You know, I think that the president-elect and certainly the senior economic team is very much in sync with Ernie's vision. And I think that Ernie has got exactly the right kind of vision over the long term. I think the problem is that without making an immediate stimulus, we are facing a 9% unemployment rate, maybe higher. I mean, we have a crisis of jobs. And if we were even thinking about designing a high-speed train, for example, even under the very, very best of circumstances, that's a couple of years away before we could actually start digging.
Can we have it both ways? Can we afford it anymore? Can we, you know, throw the jobs money at this crisis right now and have the money in the bank to be able to lend it to build out the kind of America for this century that Ernie envisions there?
Well, I mean, one of the problems is that if you don't have a – if unemployment goes up too high and you have essentially the destruction of the private sector as an investment sector, I mean, you can't have the kind of investments that Ernie is talking about. So you have to put people back to work. I mean, we absolutely have to do that. And the question is, how do you do that fast? And I think that the president-elect has made the point that there are a lot of jobs that need to be done. I mean, for example, in the national parks. National parks have every single year over the last 10 years, they have asked for hundreds of millions of dollars for basic park maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
They have asked for, last year they asked for something like $500 million. They got about $5 million. I mean,
the trails are falling down the cliff sides.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, there are basic things, basic kind of maintenance that needs to be done right now that can put people to work right now. And I think that the challenges are going to be to administer this money, to make sure that we get money out quickly, to mitigate against the risk of fraud and inefficiency as we distribute that money. But that has got to be the first priority, to rescue this patient, being the U.S. economy.
Rescue the patient, and then let's get him up and really going. Ernie and others, I like the way you're thinking. Let's hope we see that kind of thinking in Washington as well. Linda Bilmes' new book, The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Service, will be out next month. She lectures in budgeting and public finance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Linda, thank you very much for being in with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.